The court will now call the third case on the 9 o'clock docket, Jeffrey Evan Fredrickson versus the State of Texas.
Good morning, Your Honors. How are y'all doing today?
Morning.
So let's get to some crime, I guess.
Thank you for bringing us such interesting facts.
Good. I like that. It interests me a little bit more than the civil stuff, but y'all have to do both. So
well, this
I don't know
was quite a tale.
Isn't it? It's fun. And actually, I really appreciate the court allowing me the opportunity to argue. I know y'all's time is very important, but this case is real important. It's interesting, and it's kind of fun, just based on the facts of the case. But also, I think it's kind of what our court system and the appellate procedures is meant to do and deal with. Because it talks about looking at and really being intelligent and logical in application of a law that people kind of have not reassessed and not explored. And so I love the legal inquiry that's involved in this case. I do understand the limitations that the state has pointed out in their brief, in that on these type of things, there's stare decisis that somewhat binds this particular court. However,
I'll tell you that stare decisis just gets in the way all the time, doesn't it?
Somewhat might not be strong enough.
Well, and I understand that, but I also think we wouldn't have things like Crawford. We wouldn't have things like Apprendi. We can all say a lot of other cases that have come up. This court also has a voice, though, and I do believe that. And we also can look at this statutorily and interpret the statute from the application to the facts of the case. And I do think y'all have a voice and a right to do that, regardless of some other case law that have interpreted different facts differently. So we'll begin with my first point of error, which is the sufficiency of the evidence to prove aggravated robbery. I challenge factual and legal sufficiency, of course. And the facts of the case are very fun in that this was basically a burglary of a garage gone bad. And the appellant was in the garage when the victim goes out in the middle of the night to had the munchies and went to get something to eat. He bolts from the garage, and the victim, quite to his credit, obviously a very strong man, keeps telling him, you better stop. Appellant doesn't stop. He ultimately tackles him, takes the stuff back. It spills out, and he realizes that he's had stuff in the bag that appellant's carrying that belongs to the victim, which obviously ignites the victim, which would me too, including his camera from his wedding. So he's mad. Obviously a violation of his personal rights. He hits the appellant, grabs his stuff, puts the camera in his pocket, and reobtains his possessions. It's my argument that at that juncture, the robbery is completed. When the possessions are taken back by the victim, he gets the defendant or the appellant in a headlock. They're coming, he's going to take him back, and he says, I'm taking you back. I'm calling the police. You're going to jail. And it's at that point that appellant reaches in his pocket as he's being drugged back in a headlock, grabs a pocket knife, and stabs the victim. I guess the victim is so incensed, justifiably, that he doesn't realize he's even been stabbed till appellant starts screaming at him, I've stabbed you, I've stabbed you. He doesn't even believe him then at that point. And then he looks down and sees blood. The pocket knife gets dropped, and a whole chain of events occurs where appellant gets stabbed by the victim. He also gets his rear end kicked by a bunch of people at the apartment complex waiting on the police. He ends up getting tasered, all a bad scene, and probably justified to appellant. But all of that is after the fact of the robbery. So that comes to the application of the law of the facts in this particular case. And that is, when you look at the robbery statute, just in and of itself, if we assess 2902, it states that in the course of committing theft and with the intent to obtain or maintain control of the property. And it's my position that and with the intent to obtain or maintain control of property is a statutory requirement simply because that's what the law says. And when we start going through a factual analysis of the case law, I got real interested in it, because when you look at it, you see that basically in the legal analysis, when you look at sufficiency, they have written that language out of the statute by the way they've interpreted it. And I'm asking this court to interpret and assess the sufficiency of the evidence in this case in terms of the law, the statutory law, which requires that for a robbery conviction, the threatened or placed in fear with the knife, when he had the knife out and he stabbed the victim, that had to be in the course of committing theft and with the intent to obtain or maintain control of property. And the state has basically conceded in their brief that that did not occur, as far as he wasn't trying to get the property back, he wasn't trying to flee with the property, that none of that happened. They're simply saying that that's okay. The law says he can stab him because in the course of committing theft has a different definition, which includes an attempt, during, or flight. And that broadening of that language or definition of in the course of committing theft, the state feels is appropriate to expand it and basically write out, but also with the intent to obtain or maintain control of the property. If you look at the case law, you can see where it begins, and it begins with the Leitner case. It's real easy to follow the chron. That's the other thing I like about this, how the events fall out chronologically as far as the case law goes, because basically we have the expansion in 1976 of the Penal Code. And in that expansion, they really were doing two things. One doesn't apply in this case. But the expansion meant they wanted to do, in the course of committing theft, you commit violence. Okay, so we're going to include, even though you didn't get the property, if you use violence to obtain or maintain control of that property, you're still going to get charged. If you use violence in flight thereof, and it's with the intent to obtain or maintain control of the property, we're going to include that now. So you can't do something, steal something, and then try to get away with it and do violence to somebody and get away with that. That's now going to be a robbery, not a separate offense, according to the 76 code. They also added that it could be reckless assault, but that's not applicable to this particular issue. In Leitner, that's the first case where they talk about this new statute. And if you notice, all of the cases are going to cite the same chain of cases all the way down to the state's brief. Everybody's going to rely on these same chain of cases, so really looking at them is extremely important, I believe. In Leitner, there was stolen money in the car. He stole the money. He was leaving in the car with the stolen property and tried to run over a police officer afterwards. So it was one of the first cases that got to use the expanded version. And in that Leitner case, they said the new statute includes not only taking of property, but immediate efforts to keep that stolen property. So with that case, it was okay, except for some of the language was a little broad. And then we get to the Brown case, which is the next case after Leitner. And they start using broader language in there. In that particular case, in the Brown case, the defendant in Brown took money from a desk while the person wasn't looking, took out and ran. The victim confronted him at the car. So now we have that expanded version of an attempt to flee, but it was with the property. And I think that's what's real important, because they're still using the same language, but the factual basis of the case is still with the intent to obtain or maintain control of the property. So you had that element, even though the legal analysis, when somebody looks up a case site, may not include that language that's starting to get written out of the law.
Couldn't the jury have inferred that he, when he got out the knife and stabbed the victim, that he was intending to reobtain possession of the property?
I don't think there's any evidence to support that.
But
I don't think that would be a reasonable conclusion from the evidence that the jury heard. I think he was definitely trying to flee. He was definitely trying to get away from that point on.
But maybe he wanted the victim to drop the sack and he was going to get it and go. I mean, I'm seriously asking, isn't that a reasonable inference from the evidence that the jury could have made?
I don't think in this case it is a reasonable inference from the evidence, because he was squalling, let me go, let me go. I mean, the guy's dragging him back. He never made a movement. He never reached around, tried to grab the bag. I think he, from all the evidence from that point all the way forward, I mean, after he tackled him and got him down on the ground, there's some evidence about what happened where he swings and misses and the victim clocks him and knocks him down. He's never trying to reach for any of the property. And I think even the state sees that, because from the nature of their brief, they're saying it doesn't matter, that they basically concede. He didn't use the knife to try, or at least there's no evidence in the record that he used the knife to try to obtain that property or get it back from the victim. He was trying to get out of there. He was trying to get out of there when the cops got there and they had to taser him. He just didn't want to go to jail. And I think it would be speculative or outside the record to say that on these given facts, is my opinion. In Brown, they talk about the expanded statute, but they don't use the language, and he did it with the intent, you know, he caused the assault of conduct with the victim in flight, is what they say. So the evidence is sufficient to sustain it. They leave out the language "and with the intent to continue his control over the property," because the facts were there. He did have the property. He was still trying to do it. It was after the fact, but the violence was with the intent to obtain or maintain control of the property. So this is how we see some of the language getting broadened and then just cited afterwards, if the court understands what I'm saying.
Excuse me, aren't you really requiring, though, two different intents? In other words, temporally, one at the very beginning and then one later? I mean, because in this situation, the facts changed as this whole event was unfolding.
Absolutely.
And so it seems like you're adding that they have to have this intent at the beginning of the theft and then again as they're committing the assault.
I don't mean to make that argument. I just think that any kind of violent conduct has to be, just like the statute says, and with the intent to obtain or maintain control of the property. That's the impetus of a theft or a robbery or any of the stealing of the or capital murder or robbery, is that it's to get the stuff or to get away from trying to steal the stuff. But the statute, and it could happen at any time. If he had been grabbing at the bag, trying to get the victim with a knife, I think that's a whole different ballgame. That's a robbery. If he's got the bag in the car and tries to run over the cop as he's fleeing, that's an aggravated robbery. Absolutely has to have all of those elements at any time during the course of conduct. I think that's why they broadened it, because you can't go in and rob a store and then kill a police officer on the way when you're fleeing with the goods and not be charged and be liable for the death penalty. That's a murder robbery. But I don't think it's, you know, at different times. I think it's ongoing conduct in the course of that transaction. But the statute is very clear, even with the expansion, that it's in the course of committing theft and, it's a very specific word, not and or, and, which means it's an essential element, and with the intent to obtain or maintain control of property. Okay, I'm going to blow through the rest of this because Uola is the next case, and that's the first case that starts the bad line where there's absolutely no mention of an intent to obtain or maintain control, and in that case there was no evidence that he was trying to obtain or maintain control. And then comes the coup de grace shot to this law, in my opinion, and that's the White case. And the thing about White, bad facts make bad law. I learned that when I was a briefing attorney on the Court of Criminal Appeals. And that case, the facts were bad. It was a very sad situation. A bystander was shot. They tried to grab a bag from a lady, lost the bag as they're driving away. So that's going to be in flight without an intent to obtain or maintain control of the property under the law. The other guy shoots a bystander that's trying to stop them. And based on the letter of the law, that shouldn't be an aggravated robbery. But there's bad facts, and the court just basically says, well, yeah, we're going to say it is. And I think the thing that's really telling in that White case is that they selectively discuss that practice commentary. And I'll refer you to page 16 of my brief very quickly, because I quote in there specifically what the White Court says, but more importantly is what they don't say, which is in the practice commentary they say very specifically, as in prior law, the violence used or threatened must be for the purpose of compelling acquiescence to the theft or of preventing or overcoming resistance to the theft. Violence used or threatened for some purpose unrelated is a separate offense, i.e. assault, in this case, aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. When he stabbed the guy, that's an aggravated assault. There's no question about it. It's just not a robbery under the law.
So what you're saying is that if someone commits a robbery and they have their bag of stuff, mm-hmm. and the police say halt, they can drop the bag and shoot, and then they no longer have the intent to obtain or maintain.
I think that's for based on the facts, that's going to be what somebody can discern. I think dropping the bag right here and shooting a police officer is still going to be proof of an intent to obtain or maintain control of the property, where you're going to get a different issue if he throws the bag back to them. If he totally rescinds that, the theft is completed. It's not with the intent to obtain. It's a capital murder because you've shot a police officer, but under the law, it is definitely not an aggravated robbery. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen. Mr. Wilkins.
May it please the court. I did not intend to begin with an analysis of the facts as under appellant's unconvincing interpretation of the statute. However, given Justice Walker's question, I'll begin at the end, if you will. Yes, the state maintains that even under appellant's interpretation of the statute, which we maintain is incorrect and is also controlled by controlling precedent from the Court of Criminal Appeals, from this court under stare decisis, and from the recodification of the statute in 1994 in light of the interpretation of White in 84. Putting all those aside, if their interpretation of the statute is correct, the evidence is still sufficient under the record. As Justice Walker pointed out, the scenario was the victim was walking back towards his apartment with the defendant in one hand, appellant in one hand, and the bag of stolen property in the other. Appellant stabbed him. He released the appellant and dropped the bag. Then the two squared off over the dropped knife. As appellant points out, there's no evidence that he directly tried to grab the bag. However, as the victim pointed out, and as he testified on volume 3, page 231, he was never given the opportunity to try for the bag because the victim prevented him from doing that. They squared off the knife, the victim grabbed the knife, ended up stabbing him, and then got him in a headlock again. I think it can be inferred, however, from his conduct in stealing the goods from the garage in the first place, running away and refusing to drop the bag while he was being chased, the fact that he only released the bag after he had been hit in the side, it's unclear from the record whether he'd been hit in the shoulder, in the neck, or whether in the head. But it's then and only then that he releases, and actually the victim testifies that it sprawls on the ground and it opens up, and that's when he sees all these stolen items, including his camera. I think the jury could infer from all that conduct that in stabbing the victim, he wasn't simply trying to escape, but he was trying to escape and regain control of the bag. That alone in itself would be enough to sustain the conviction for robbery under appellant's interpretation of the statute. As the state's maintained in its brief, however, we believe that interpretation is incorrect given the controlling precedent, the stare decisis, the fact that their interpretation actually reads out part of the statute, the one thing that they're complaining that the White Court does. In the course of committing theft is defined as conduct that occurs in an attempt to commit during the commission or in the immediate flight after the attempt. Under appellant's interpretation, it would completely read that phrase, immediate flight after the attempt, out of the definition of course of committing theft. The only way to reconcile those two is the way that White does it, which is to say the phrase to obtain or maintain control of the property, that goes to the intent to maintain the property during the theft and not during the assaultive portion of the robbery. Happy to go over the precedent and everything else, but unless the state has any questions, unless the court has any questions, the state prays for an affirmance.
Does the state have any questions? Oh, okay. Ms. Mullen.
I guess here's my question. If the statute says aggravated robbery is violence committed in the course of committing theft and with the intent to obtain and maintain control of property, what does that mean? I mean, how do we apply that?
Well, doesn't it mean what the courts have said it means?
And I don't think so. I think the court had a bad case.
Okay, so you think that the legislature disagrees with what the courts have said it means, correct?
Well, I know where you're going with that.
Yeah, exactly. Why hadn't the legislature, done something about it in 30 years?
Because I haven't been here arguing about this.
Okay.
How's
well,
that? No, I mean, really.
They're going to be in session, I think, let's see, next year or the year after.
But, I mean, in reality, no, I don't. I think people have kind of settled in with that. It doesn't get raised that often, I do think. I think typically it's a stand-up aggravated robbery kind of case. But I also think how things get changed legislatively is when some horrible verdict comes out that the legislature doesn't like. It's got to get a lot of publicity. And I think that's truly and honestly why the legislature hasn't re-looked at that. Obviously, it wouldn't, and also it probably wouldn't be very politically viable to, legislatively make what people could argue would be a statute of aggravated robbery less, of a penalty, if you understand what I'm saying. I don't think a politician really wants that to happen. But
according to your interpretation, that's what the legislature intended 30 years ago, right?
I think that's exactly what they said 30 years ago. I mean, and they didn't have the internet then, so they were a little less having to abide by public demands. But I do think that's what the practice commentary specifically says they intended. And also, it goes in a bigger picture, doesn't it go to our understanding of what a robbery is? I mean, it's stealing somebody's stuff with violence. And, I mean, it may be an aggravated assault, it may be a capital murder, it may be a murder, it may be attempted murder, but we ought to call it what it is under the statute and not say, okay, and with the intent to obtain or maintain control of property, we don't really care about that.
When was the last time the Court of Criminal Appeals looked at this particular issue, do you recall?
I don't recall because I didn't look. There was no main case after the last case I cited. That's been cited over, where you start getting those circular citations where you're coming back to the seminal cases. It's going to be after that a number of years.
Well, they do. I mean, they can overrule their own precedent, but we're constrained. I'm sorry.
Oh, when is it, Jim?
I believe it was the Lawton case.
That's the light one. Oh, yeah, the Lawton case, yes. A little different than those major cases that I was talking about. What were you saying, Judge?
I just said they can overrule their own precedent. We just don't have the authority to do that.
But you do have authority, and this is what I'm asking, to look at the facts, sufficiency of the evidence in light of the statute. And, go out there and let's erase some news.
Make some law, huh?
Yeah, let's make some law. Thank you. If you have any other questions, okay. No. I appreciate the court's time.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mullen and Mr. Wilkinson. We appreciate your time here this morning to present your arguments in this very interesting case. The case is submitted, and since we have no other arguments to hear, we'll ask the clerk to adjourn us.